As the U.S. attempts to pull out of Afghanistan after two decades of war in the Middle East, we size up the costs on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Since the 9/11 attacks, the U.S. has spent more than $2.2 trillion to finance the war in Afghanistan, that accounting by the costs of war project that has, since 2010, pooled the work of dozens of scholars to provide the fullest accounting of the human, economic, and political costs. What has the U.S. accomplished by being in Afghanistan? How do you feel about the war today? Was it worth it? 800-642-1234. Nita Crawford, she is a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Boston University. She co-founded and co-directs the Costs of War Project, which is housed at Brown University. Nita, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
I'm happy to be with you, Kate.
Well, we spoke in 2019 after the release of the Afghanistan papers, these documents revealing that top policymakers didn't see the Afghanistan war as winnable. Now, as we see the Taliban retake the country, what is your reaction?
Well, something that was foreseeable and foreseen is nevertheless still unfortunate. And even now, there are policy options for the United States. I wish I hope that we're creative in our responses.
When you say there are policy options for the U.S., what might those be?
Well, for example, the U.S. has already worked with its allies. Unfortunately, we didn't work with them on the withdrawal, but we're working with them now on putting diplomatic pressure on the Taliban to ensure that they keep the promises that they made. I don't know that we have too many levers, but that's one lever. A second thing that we can do is expedite, as we are, the removal of people who are at risk. Again, you know, mistakes were made, as they said, in the 1970s, and, you know, we're behind on that. Another policy option is to put pressure on Pakistan, using whatever leverage we can, who can then indirectly pressure the Taliban to behave better.
There are grave concerns that Afghans who aided the U.S. and their families are under violent threat from the Taliban if they remain in the country. Can you give us a sense of how much of that threat there is?
Well, I think it's real. Now, we don't know in every instance how many of the Taliban will obey the orders. They're an organization which is loose and necessarily so when you fight an insurgency. Chains of command are not extremely tight. People have autonomy. So even if at the top the order is given that you're not to engage in, quote, retribution for People's Alliance and working with the United States, that may not be the case. There still may be retribution. I suspect that, you know, as much as the Taliban has enjoyed the fact that they haven't had to govern all of Afghanistan, they now are faced with the reality of having to govern Afghanistan, and you can't kill everyone everywhere. You can't threaten everyone everywhere and expect to have people actually work with you. So there is a limit to what they will do.
Nita, how closely does the modern Taliban in this day resemble the Taliban that existed when American military forces invaded after the attacks?
Well, that's a good question that I don't have an answer to. I think if we knew the answer to that, we would have been better at actually engaging the Taliban. One thing that's true is that they've had tremendous turnover in leadership. You recall that year after year where we were told that the United States has killed the top leadership of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Oh, we've killed leader X. We've killed leader Y. But each time we've killed a leader, a new leader has arisen. So the leadership is younger. They may be angrier. They may also, and it's likely the case, be more willing to work with people than the previous leadership was. So there's contradictory tendencies. We don't really know enough, I think, about the leadership of the Taliban.
Nita Crawford is with us, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Boston University, giving her assessment of the situation in Afghanistan, also through the lens of the Costs of War Project, which we'll be talking about here. You can join in with your assessment, 800-642-1234. Andrew is joining us from Palmyra. Andrew, hi.
Hi, how's everybody doing this morning?
Doing well. What is your assessment?
My assessment would be that if you look at any of the foreign policy that the United States has had in the last 20 years in the Middle East and then through North Africa, looking at Libya, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, every time that we have gotten involved, we've taken out top leadership, as your guest pointed out, but then there's a massive power vacuum and then you have conditions worsen for the people who live there. And I don't see why the United States should be continually involved in these wars where we send a bunch of young men over to get maimed or killed. And, you know, I don't see the benefit to it. And I think that people need to take a step back and really look at whether or not that's our role to be trying to go around the world and stick guns in people's faces and say, you're going to take our democracy and you're going to like it.
Andrew, thank you for calling in. Nita, you know, Andrew addressing the massive power vacuum, what do you see in his thoughts?
Well, he's raised a number of interesting points. I think that's right. This is an inexperienced group that's going to take over Afghanistan. They have been running large sections of the country. Recall that the United States has been losing this war for more than 10 years. They have had control of large sections of the country, but they haven't had to control this much territory this quickly. And I think that that's going to create issues for them. They may then get more violent, but on the long run, they'll have to become more cooperative with the citizens if they expect to have any kind of governance. On the larger issue of the United States engagement over the last, I'd say, 40 years since we decided that we had to go protect oil and make sure that there was access to oil, not just for the United States, but for the rest of the world. We have engaged in policies which are sometimes helpful and productive, but often they're counterproductive because they bolster governments which are friendly to our oil interests, but not democratic. And that leads to people in those countries protesting and disliking not just their government, but our government because we support their government. Mm-hmm. And that's the root of these insurgencies and sometimes these terrorist organizations in reaction to governments that are corrupt, as you know, the Afghan government was, and also bolstered by the United States in terms of advisors, arms, and sometimes even troops.
Andrew mentioned the casualties of war, and U.S. service members represent fewer than 1% of direct war deaths. That's your costs of war assessment, and I was kind of surprised by that because the devastating casualties that your project has found, by comparison, is quite breathtaking. Can you explain?
Well, in the long run, you know, over the last several decades, there's two things that have happened which have reduced U.S. casualties. One is there's been a great improvement in medicine, and many more people are surviving their injuries in the field because they're treated right there or they're evacuated quickly to a location where their injuries can be treated. So that's led to a decrease in the number of deaths. We still have tens of thousands of U.S. service members, men and women, who have been injured, sometimes gravely. And these are visible wounds and invisible wounds. And then the other way that the United States has reduced its casualties is to use air power. Now, when it uses air power from 15,000, 20,000 feet, and it's bombing urban areas or areas where they think that there's a concentration of militants, they're often harming not just militants, but civilians. Just the sheer size of the weapon, a 500-pound weapon detonated in an urban area will destroy a lot, directly with the blast, but then it will set off fires which kill more people or injure more people. So any time you use force, especially if you're using force from afar, you can't see who you're targeting necessarily or identify them, it's possible that you will kill civilians. And that's what we've done. And that's the other side as well. So the great toll of these post-9/11 wars on civilians is that we've used a lot of firepower, much of it from the air. And it's also the toll on civilians is also due to the fact that the other side doesn't necessarily care as much about civilians.
Mm.
They're both more desperate, and in some cases, they believe that they need to be coercive in order to get civilians to go along with them, to provide them with food or shelter or information about the U.S. and its allies.
We have Boston University political science professor Nita Crawford, co-directs the Costs of War Project. Her research delves deeply into the human, financial, environmental, the social costs of the post-9/11 wars. How has the war in Afghanistan affected your life personally? Do you know someone who has fought in Afghanistan? Have you been deployed to the Middle East? What are your thoughts on the images you see coming out of Afghanistan? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up in a minute with Nita Crawford here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing post-9/11 wars on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. War is expensive. That's from the Costs of War Project in a report last year. War is expensive in terms of lives lost, physical damage to people and property, mental trauma to soldiers and war zone inhabitants, and in terms of money, end quote. As Kabul fell on Sunday, reestablishing Taliban rule over Afghanistan for the first time in 20 years, we're checking in on those costs of war. With your insights, 800-642-1234. We have Nita Crawford, who chairs the political science department at Boston University, co-founded the Costs of War Project. Nita, the president told ABC News yesterday it was a simple choice to withdraw, and Biden faulted the Afghan government and its military for not more forcibly defending Kabul. Can you break down how that training has been for the U.S. and why the U.S. feels like the Afghan government didn't do its part?
Well, the United States spent a lot of effort equipping and clothing and paying and training the Afghan military police. Much of that effort actually accelerated later into the war. So it's not been 20 years or 19 and a half years of training, but it's accelerated. And I believe that there were still problems with that, in that there's the maintenance of the great advantage that the Afghan security forces had was of their aircraft. When the United States pulled contractors and its own personnel, military personnel, from maintaining aircraft, that made it much more difficult for the Afghan Air Force to maintain their own aircraft. Mm. They also had that's what they've used in many cases to sort of pull their ground forces out of danger by bringing in air power. The Afghan military also had logistical problems. Even getting ammunition to people was difficult, not to mention water and anything else they might need. Mm. So in instance after instance, they fought very hard, but and they fought hard for the last several years and taken many more casualties in terms of people killed and injured than external forces, international forces. So I believe that when they chose not to fight, for instance, in Kabul, they were wise in that it would have been difficult for them to win, given their challenges logistically. They were surrounded, and what they chose was not to lob weapons inside and outside the city, which would have necessarily, clearly killed many civilians.
Yeah.
So I believe it was the right thing to do to stand down in the face of that. And I think that that's the lesson of having been overrun in city after city, lacking the kind of capacity that they would have needed to win. And, with many years of taking a lot of casualties under their belt.
Yeah.
So I don't fault the Afghan military, especially for not fighting over Kabul. I think it was wise.
Nina Crawford, political science professor at Boston University, co-directs the Costs of War Project. Gathering your insights as well, what do you think of America's forever war? 800-642-1234. Rosa is joining us from Waterford. Good morning, Rosa.
Good morning, ladies. So my cousin Warner served in Afghanistan. He came in shortly after the initial invasion by America into Afghanistan. He said what he saw was that he and his fellow soldiers had to guard the poppy fields because the Taliban started burning the poppy fields, which makes the heroin. And shortly after they started burning the poppy fields, America invaded. So that's what the Taliban, in my opinion, is about. They don't want heroin made.
So it was the resources, the poppy fields, that Rosa is bringing up. Nita, what do you know about that?
Well, the United States has targeted all Taliban income, and that includes any income that they derive from basically shaking down local people at the point at gunpoint, and also by forcing Afghan farmers to grow poppy or enticing them to grow poppy because poppy is profitable. Mm. So what the U.S. and its allies have done is engaged in what they call counter-narcotics, and that entails burning and otherwise destroying with chemicals dropped from the air any fields that are used to grow poppy that the U.S. can find. And that's just simply the same kind of thing that we've done in Iraq and Syria. So when ISIS controlled oil fields, we would destroy the wellheads or the machinery used to extract the oil or the storage facilities for the oil, just so that we could cut off their income.
What does the Taliban's takeover mean for women and children?
Well, it's almost it's a double tragedy. First of all, war is always bad for women, children, very young people suffer much more than we can imagine, especially, but also older people, men and women. And what it means for non-combatant civilians is that on the one hand, perhaps the immediate fighting will end and they'll get some reprieve. But on the other hand, it means, I think, that it's likely that they'll see a return to the kind of draconian rule that the Taliban believes is essential.
What are you watching for next in Afghanistan? What are you keeping an eye on?
Well, I am worried about humanitarian catastrophe. That is, when the international community puts pressure on the Taliban to straighten up and fly right, that is, keep their commitments to protecting the rights of women, They may impose very harsh sanctions in order to get them to do what we believe is right, what I believe is right. But that can actually end up hurting the women and children you just mentioned more than even what the Taliban is doing. So we've got to be very careful. I'm looking at the international reaction to see how it's calibrated so that any sanctions that we impose are targeted and focused on the people who can actually change the policy. Mm-hmm. Another thing, of course, I'm watching is how the Taliban behave. And then finally, the rate of the U.S. withdrawal and evacuation of the individuals that we said we were trying to get out. If we can increase that, that'd be wonderful.
Nita, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Nita Crawford, Chair of the Department of Political Science at Boston University. At this hour, you have aligned to Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan. News update is next.